Now, Monitor brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence Spivak. Ready for the unrehearsed conference of four of America's top reporters to question James J. Wadsworth, new United States Ambassador to the United Nations. He is the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Our program comes to you today from New York, where the General Assembly of the United Nations is the center of world attention. Our guest is U.N. Ambassador James J. Wadsworth, who on Friday delivered this country's reply to the speech of Soviet Premier Khrushchev. He called an effort to destroy the United Nations. Ambassador Wadsworth has had long experience in negotiations with the Soviet Union. Before taking over the U.N. position previously held by Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge, Mr. Wadsworth served for 7 years as Mr. Lodge's deputy. He has been the United States representative on disarmament, and he was the chief delegate to the Geneva Conference on banning the testing of nuclear weapons. We'll start the questions today with Mr. Spivak.
Ambassador Wadsworth, you've said that Mr. Khrushchev's speech has created a crisis in the United Nations. Why should that be so when there is nothing he can do about firing Mr. Hammarskjöld, particularly if we vetoed?
I think, Mr. Spivak, that this has created a crisis, not so much for what might be done immediately, but for the eventual future of the United Nations. He has attempted, I think, in this thing to destroy the structure of the Secretariat of the United Nations, and with his proposal, I think that it just couldn't work.
Well, can you tell us what the effect of Mr. Khrushchev's attack has been on Secretary General Hammarskjöld's position in the United Nations up to now? Has it weakened it or has it strengthened it?
I think that it has strengthened it. Everything we hear from the other delegations seem to indicate that they resent very definitely the attempt by Mr. Khrushchev to destroy this particular office.
Well, then why do you say, then, it is a crisis if it has actually strengthened Mr. Hammarskjöld's position? Where is the crisis as it affects the UN?
One would say that it was a crisis because it's the first direct and complete massive challenge to the UN as it is now constituted. And that, in our opinion, constitutes a crisis.
Well, now, what do you think Mr. Khrushchev's aim in all this? Is it to destroy the UN, or is it to try to get control of it?
I think it's one of those crystal ball situations there that you can't really be absolutely sure of. But our own opinion is that he would rather destroy because he cannot control.
Well, why doesn't he just walk out?
Because that would not destroy. The rest of the United States Nations would remain there.
Well, you say, then, that there is little chance, or rather hope, that Mr. Khrushchev may leave the United Nations and leave the United Nations to the peace-loving nation?
I should say that there would not be too much chance of his attempting to leave the United Nations for the purpose of destroying it or breaking it up. I should say that there is the possibility that eventually, having found out that he can't get anywhere, he personally may leave, and I hope he does.
Mr. Wadsworth, one more question. I understand that Article 6, Chapter 2 of the UN Charter requires expulsion of any member who has consistently violated its principle. Why doesn't the UN do something about the Soviet Union, a nation that has consistently violated the principles of the United Nations?
I think the answer to that is simple, Mr. Spivak. It can't be done because of the rules itself of the United Nations.
Well, can't it be brought up for discussion, at least, in debate?
It might be brought up for discussion, but after all, if you come to a situation where a member has to vote against itself, which would be the case in this particular matter, it doesn't seem to be too realistic.
Wouldn't it point up, though, the absurdity of the Soviets' position?
I think anything that point up their absurdity is a good thing, but I'm not sure that it would be very fruitful.
Mr. Hensley.
Mr. Ambassador, despite the various diplomatic questions here, one of the big questions in everyone's mind was whether Mr. Eisenhower and Mr. Khrushchev might meet here, despite the indications that there were very few chances they would. I'd like to ask you whether you think what has happened so far in the UN improves or worsens possibilities of a meeting between the two men.
You're asking, of course, there for a personal opinion, Mr. Hensley. My personal opinion is that it is against their possibility of meeting.
I'd like to ask a follow-up on Mr. Spivak's question with respect to Mr. Hammarskjöld personally, not the structure question or anything, but you say that, of course, he's strengthened among many people by this Soviet attack on him. But will he find it any more possible than former Secretary General Trygve Lie did to continue to operate effectively if a certain bloc, 9, 10, or 20, of the nations of the United Nations just simply won't have anything to do with him?
One doesn't know the answer to that at this early date. I would think probably that he would be able to continue to operate effectively.
One other question I'd like to ask you about Secretary Herter's statement the other day, in which he said that President Nkrumah of Ghana was either leaning to or in the Soviet camp. Do you agree with that statement?
I find no reason to disagree with it. We have to study his speech very carefully to find out. It gave us the first impression that supporting Mr. Lumumba and in other directions, it seemed to be more toward the Soviet camp than toward the other side.
Ms. Frederick.
Ambassador Wadsworth, first a question about your office. When, during the tenure of Ambassador Lodge, the delegate to the United Nations was a member of the President's cabinet, is it your understanding that this status will be continued at this high level in view of the great importance the President attached to the United Nations in his speech the other day?
Well, Ms. Frederick, that has not been discussed as yet, and so I can't answer the question.
As of now, you are not a member of the cabinet.
As of now.
You have had a great deal of experience in negotiating the subject of disarmament, many facets of it, and have been very patient with many months of negotiation with the Soviet Union. Is it realistic to believe that any effective disarmament agreement can be reached even if the Russians are ready to enter into such an agreement, if the People's Republic of China is not included in such an agreement?
Yes, it's always possible to reach a general agreement on basic principles and basic objectives. I'm not sure that that can be done, of course, here at the United Nations.
But can you have effective control and inspection unless the Chinese mainland is covered by such control and inspection?
I will have to go a little bit apart from that and say that in some cases there is no question but what we would have to have the agreement of the Chinese mainland regime. That was particularly true from the standpoint of the nuclear test ban treaty. As to the rest of the situation, I'm not in a position to say at this time. Generally, one would admit that one would have to have all of the more important people in the picture.
Congressman Bowles, I believe it was, has said that the coming administration is going to have to deal increasingly with China, the People's Republic of China, on various matters because of their increasing strength. Would you agree with this?
One doesn't know. It depends entirely on how they handle themselves. Mm-hmm. If they show themselves willing to negotiate seriously or to talk seriously, then that would make a very different situation than we have today.
Tomorrow in the steering committee, when the subject of representation of Red China comes up, what will our position be to delay the discussion for another year?
By all means, we are absolutely determined to delay the reception of Communist China.
Mr. Hamilton.
Ambassador Wadsworth, Mr. Khrushchev said yesterday at Glen Cove that there couldn't be any disarmament agreement unless the matter of the Secretary Generalship of the UN was settled. You being an expert in this field of negotiating disarmament with the Russians, can you tell us where you see any kind of negotiations ahead with them, in the assembly or in the 10-power group or where?
Frankly, Mr. Hamilton, to me, what Mr. Khrushchev has said is a non sequitur. It just doesn't mean much of anything. In the first place, you can't talk very much about postponing discussion on disarmament until after you settle the question of the Secretary General, because settling the question of the Secretary General will take a long time.
So you then, of course, said we know that no discussions until that is settled. I presume his way. He didn't say it quite that.
Well, if this is what he means, this means to me that he's not the slightest bit anxious to talk seriously about disarmament.
Well, you agree with what some delegates think, that a year ago, the big communist theme song was fixed by Mr. Khrushchev in his speech to the assembly as being general and complete disarmament. That he has milked that one pretty dry, and that he's now turned to the new one, which is all the colonies of the world must be freed this year or immediately. Is that your impression? Is what the real purpose of his speech was?
I don't think anybody has a good enough crystal ball to be able to state with certitude exactly what his meaning is. But obviously he's going on with his usual situation of changing position and attempting to throw the West off balance, and I can assure you that he's not going to do it.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Ambassador, Mr. Khrushchev and the other leaders of the Communist bloc have been here now for about a week. How would you appraise the good or evil they've done since they've been here?
From the standpoint of evil, I suppose I would be unfair to the information media of the United States, because I think they've given them more space, perhaps, than they deserved. From the standpoint of the United Nations, I think they've done the West some good. I think they've overplayed their hand. I think they've shown themselves to be utterly intransigent on many things which the rest of the world wished them to be reasonable about.
Mr. Ambassador, if Mr. Khrushchev's speech is indicative of his attitude toward the problem to be taken up by the United Nations, do you think much can be done in this session of the Assembly by the United Nations?
My own opinion, Mr. Spivak, is that if he insists that this is the agenda that must be followed, then this 15th General Assembly of the United Nations is going to be an absolute washout.
What objectives do we, the United States, or do you have in this session? What would you like to see realized that you think can be realized if Mr. Khrushchev isn't as recalcitrant as he has been?
Well, I think there, Mr. Spivak, one should go back to the speech of President Eisenhower and follow out all the constructive things that he has suggested, not only for Africa, but for other undeveloped countries. I think we should go back to the idea of being perfectly willing to negotiate seriously if only the other side is willing also to negotiate.
One more question on another subject. The other day, Premier Khrushchev was quoted as saying, an agreement on the discontinuation of nuclear weapon tests will shortly be reached. Now, you weren't quite as optimistic about that as he is. I think you took sharp issue with him. If he tells his negotiators, however, to agree to our terms now, won't there be an agreement?
There is the possibility that there can be an agreement. As of the time I left Geneva, there was no possibility as long as the Soviet would continue to hold the position that it then had.
Is there any possibility that if he does now agree to our terms, that we may walk away from some of our terms?
I don't think there's a question of walking away. There's a question of serious negotiation, of agreement through compromise and negotiation. There's no question of erosion of an original position of the United States any more than there is an erosion of the original position of the Soviet Union. These things can be reached only if there is good faith on both sides, and as of the time I left Geneva, I did not feel that the good faith was present on the Soviet side.
Well, why should they want an agreement on nuclear testing when they are now getting everything that they want, and that is a cessation of tests without inspection, and they've had that for almost 2 years now? Why should they not continue to stall as they've been doing?
There isn't any very good reason one can give in answer to that question, Mr. Spivak. Perhaps they want to get the publicity which would result from having successfully negotiated a treaty of this kind. Perhaps they want to save the money that it would cost them if they had to continue or resume testing. Perhaps it's all kinds of things that we don't know about. Up until, say, May of this year, we thought they seriously wanted to conclude a treaty. But since May and the destruction of the summit conference in Paris, we have been wondering very seriously.
Well, now, do you think there ought to be a cutoff date, though, for us? Or do you think we ought to continue negotiating with them for month after month after month into years?
The official position of the United States is, and I agree with it, that we cannot forever simply wait and have what amounts to a moratorium without any kind of control at all. That eventually we will have to say, this far we go and no further. As to what that date should be or must be, I would have no idea at this point.
Mr. Ambassador
Hensley,
the President, in his address the other day, spoke of the necessity to keep Africa from influence by outside pressures. In other words, neutralizing it, although that may not be a word that's in good odor with the American delegation. In line with neutralizing Africa, do you think that can be done? And if it's possible, would the United States be willing to pull all the rest of its bases out of North Africa?
I'm afraid I'm not really competent to discuss that, Mr. Hensley. This is a matter which is totally outside of my own particular field, and I would rather not attempt to say anything about that except to indicate the fact that we would not have had any bases in Africa had it not been for the intransigence and the vetoes of the Soviet Union.
Another question I think that we ought to touch on the other side of this story, which it sometimes has been more of a police story than a diplomatic story the past week. And I am wondering, in the light of press reaction in some other countries, whether the United States has suffered in world opinion by its action in restricting Mr. Khrushchev to Manhattan, necessary as that may have been.
I have heard nothing, of course, from other countries as to this, except, of course, editorials that may have been called to my attention from papers published outside the United States. Seems to me that the question of security for these individuals is overriding, and for that reason the restriction should be maintained.
Wouldn't it have been possible just to go quietly to General Zakharov and tell him, we can't be responsible for your man if he's off Manhattan Island? Will he stay there quietly and avoid us having to publicly slap this on him? Couldn't it have been handled that way, Mr. Ambassador?
I'm sure. I don't know. I don't know the general, but from what I hear about him, I don't think it would have worked.
I'd like to ask you a question about Mr. Khrushchev's bosom friend he has discovered here, Mr. Castro. Do you have enough reports or intelligence in from Latin America to be able to say at this time what effect on Latin Americans generally has these antics of Khrushchev and Castro had here?
No, we have had no reports that would give us an opportunity to answer that question in a completely straightforward manner, and therefore I would prefer not to try.
Mr. Ambassador, your predecessor, Ambassador Lodge, adopted the practice of replying immediately to charges or accusations or propaganda put out by the Soviet Union, and by this he allowed the world, in many cases, to get both sides of the story at the same time. Are you planning to follow that practice, and do you consider it important?
I am planning to follow the practice. I do consider it important, and I have already started to do it. In fact, I have done it at least three times so far since I took over.
Ms. Frederick.
Mr. Ambassador, this week, President Nkrumah of Ghana spoke in the General Assembly, as you know, regarded by some people, Africans particularly, as being more or less a voice of Africa, and he called at that time for the elimination of all nuclear bases in Africa. registration of all military agreements by any African nations with the United Nations. In other words, to try to keep the big powers in the Cold War out of Africa. Now, this follows along the lines of a proposal made by Senator Mansfield that the United States try to reach an understanding with the Soviet Union to shut out all bases and military help to Africa. Is the American delegation prepared to try to see if there's any possibility of negotiating such a stand on Africa as between the two big powers?
Ms. Frederick, we're always ready to negotiate with the Soviet Union on a serious basis. In addition to Senator Mansfield, I know that you recall that President Eisenhower also talked about keeping big power politics out of Africa. We are 100% for it. We would rather run it through the UN if it takes outside agreements, bilateral agreements with the Soviet Union or anyone else, I'm sure we'd be willing to talk.
But you're willing to talk. Are you willing to take the initiative?
That I am not I'm not in a position to tell you, because at the present time, consultations and considerations of this matter are still going on.
Now, on another subject, President Nkrumah said that disarmament too frequently is associated in some countries with an industrial slowdown, and there should be a serious study made of means of redeployment of the capital resources and technical skills now used for military purposes, so that this would not be a drawback to disarmament. He proposed such a study in the United Nations. Is the United States willing to undertake with other nations such a study? Is it willing to initiate such a study of redeployment of these resources that would be released if there is any disarmament?
Here again, I think, Ms. Frederick, you've asked a question that I am not competent to answer. I know that the United States has been making such studies on its own. Whether it would be willing to go into the United Nations or through a United Nations group to continue and to coordinate such studies, I don't know. But it would seem to me not to be an illogical situation.
Mr. Hamilton.
Mr. Ambassador, perhaps you could clarify the situation with regard to the Congo, and in particular the policies that Secretary General Hameshu has followed there. I refer particularly to the statement by Mr. Khrushchev that Mr. Hameshu had been intervening on one side, namely against Premier Lumumba, by not allowing anybody to use the radio stations or airfields. And his point was that, of course, that the UN was sent its troops to the Congo at the request of Mr. Lumumba. Therefore, it mustn't do anything against him. In fact, it must help him. What's the answer to Mr. Khrushchev's statement?
I think that the situation in the Congo, Mr. Hamilton, is so confused that it's almost impossible to get a straight answer to that. Several of the contingents of United States troops, United Nations troops, have been extremely helpful to Mr. Lumumba. In fact, my recollection is that they virtually saved his life not too many days ago. The question of Mr. Lumumba and the various difficulties which are being experienced in the inner circles of the potential Congolese government are still so confused that it is very difficult indeed to make any prediction at all. At the same time, we do feel and have felt and have said very loudly and repeatedly that we think that the United Nations and the United Nations force ought to do everything they can to maintain order and peace and tranquility in the area. If that means going against a certain local leader at a certain time, I'm afraid that's too bad. That would be the kind of thing that would have to be expected in order to keep peace and tranquility.
Do you think we'll have a resolution? We'll bring in a resolution in the Assembly at this session, which would in effect say that, or would we simply say we have confidence in Mr. Hameshu and let it go at that?
I don't think that we need very much more than the resolution that was passed on a vote of 70-0 with a few abstentions in the emergency special session.
Mr. Spivak, we have about 2 minutes.
Mr. Ambassador, Mr. Nkrumah the other day suggested that permanent seats in the Security Council of the United Nations be created for Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. Would the United States approve of any more permanent seats?
I don't quite know exactly what Mr. Nkrumah meant by that, Mr. Spivak. If I did, I might be able to comment, but as of now, I really don't quite know what it means.
Well, I would assume there are now 5 permanent members. He would like a representative from each of those continents as a permanent member, in addition to the 5 that are now there.
Oh.
One from Africa, one from Asia, and one from the Middle East.
I think that would probably make things more confused than ever. At the present time, we still firmly believe that the Secretary General and his representatives are by far the most competent and the least partial of any people we could have in Africa at this time.
Mr. Ambassador, there have been reports to the effect that a neutralist bloc is forming in the UN. Have you had any indications of that?
Just from what I read in the papers and hear on the radio and television. I'm not sure that a neutralist bloc is possible because most of the people who are advertised as being forming that bloc are people who have advertised that they do not wish to join any bloc at all.
Your feeling is then that is just newspaper talk?
No, not necessarily. It's entirely possible that a buffer group may be created which will attempt to get between the 2 main power groups.
Well, Miss Frederick and gentlemen, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I see that our time is up.
Monitor's thanks to Ambassador James J. Wadsworth and to the members of the Meet the Press panel, Pauline Frederick of NBC News, Stuart Hensley of United Press International, Thomas J. Hamilton of the New York Times, and Mr. Lawrence Spivak. This has been a most interesting and stimulating half hour. Meet the Press, produced by Lawrence Spivak. At the beginning of this school year, we'd like to ask you to take a moment to think about the school years to come. In 10 years, college applications are expected to double. Our colleges and universities must be ready with more classrooms, more laboratories, and, of course, with the finest of professors. But unless something is done quickly to prepare for the future, we may be tragically unprepared. Many colleges and universities already are overcrowded with no money available for expansion or even to pay salaries to attract qualified teachers. It's a tragic fact that many professors are leaving the classroom for jobs in industry and government at twice their present salaries. It's a serious situation and even a dangerous one for the nation. If you'd like to help correct this, write to Higher Education, Box 36, Times Square Station, New York, 36, New York. That's Higher Education, Box 36, Times Square Station, New York, 36, New York.